Your Honor, I'm ready to introduce the people at council table with me, if I may. Both of Simpson Thatcher in New York, Bruce Angelillo and Jonathan Youngwood, and Mr. Angelillo, with the court's permission, will make the argument on behalf of the defendant.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, defendants.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
How are you? Good to see you again.
It's always nice to be back in this beautiful courtroom. At council table with me, Your Honor, is Mary O'Connor from the Aiken Gump firm in Dallas, and Sean Brunecke from Bouchard, Margulies, and Friedlander.
Good morning. Nice to see you all.
May it please the court. I am Stuart Shapiro. I rise to argue on behalf of the plaintiff below, Alliance Data Systems Corporation. This is an appeal from a decision by Vice Chancellor Strine dismissing our complaint. The court's review of this appeal, obviously, is de novo, and I would submit that despite my high regard for the court below, error was committed, and this decision should be reversed. This case arises out of a merger agreement between Alliance Data and a acquisition subsidiary of the Blackstone Partners private equity firm. It was a $7.8 billion merger agreement, of which $6.6 billion was being financed by banks. And the contract had three key obligations, which are the focus of this case. One was that the parties use their reasonable best efforts to close the merger as expeditiously as possible. The second was that nobody, including the parent of Aladdin, the acquisition subsidiary, do anything to keep the merger from closing or to delay it or hinder it. And the third was an obligation on the parties, including Aladdin, to provide all information, and that's an unconditional obligation, that any governmental agency wanted in connection with an approval of the merger. Alliance owns a credit card bank that is regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and so it was necessary to get OCC approval. And the complaint alleges that Aladdin breached all three of these obligations, and a breach gives rise to an obligation to pay a termination fee, what they call a business interruption fee, but a termination fee of $170 million. The key paragraph in the complaint is paragraph 33. And I'd like to read it to the court because I think it's important to focus on what the complaint actually alleges. Quote, by January 2008, Blackstone, under pressure from its lending banks, had decided not to proceed with the merger. Due to tightening credit markets, Blackstone's lenders face hundreds of millions of dollars in write-downs if the merger went forward. Rather than simply inform Alliance Data that Blackstone no longer wanted to proceed with the merger and pay the termination fee, Aladdin and other Blackstone entities took actions designed to ensure that the OCC would not approve the merger before April 18, 2008, the, quote, drop-dead, close quote, date on which Blackstone could seek to unilaterally terminate the merger agreement. Now, the complaint then goes on in specific detail to allege actions that were taken by Aladdin and Blackstone to kill this merger. And it alleges that they were successful. They delayed getting OCC action until April 18th and then sent a notice terminating the merger. Frankly, I can't imagine a clearer allegation of a breach of contract.
Now, your argument, though, presumes that Blackstone's a party, doesn't it?
No, not at all. The contract provides that Aladdin is liable if Blackstone prevents the merger. It's an unconditional obligation. What happens in these contracts, and these are very common provisions, in one place you say the parties have to use their reasonable best efforts to do things, and in another place they say they have a very broad prohibition on doing anything that will prevent or hinder or delay the merger. So in writing these contracts, lawyers recognize, in fact, Vice Chancellor's recognized in some of his opinions, it's impossible to anticipate all the things that people could do. No lawyer is smart enough. So we put in these kinds of, you shall not do anything that prevents this merger or would reasonably be expected to hinder or delay it. And not only you, the contracting party, but your parents. And 6.5.6, which is the covenant at issue, specifically identifies not only Aladdin but its parent companies as being bound by this provision in the sense that if they, the parent companies, do something that would reasonably be expected to prevent or materially hinder or delay the merger, Aladdin is liable to pay the termination fee.
Okay, and the specific thing that Blackstone did to prevent the merger was?
Well, there are a whole series of things. In January, on January 23rd, well, first of all, Blackstone and Aladdin, before January 23rd, had already decided to kill the merger because their banks told them credit markets are tightening, we're going to lose as much as $1 billion because we can't syndicate this loan. So they had a direction from the banks that they rely on for their business to kill the merger or get a lower price. On January 23rd, the OCC sent them a set of agreements. And it's important to recognize that the OCC Change of Bank Control Manual says if you want our approval, you're going to have to enter into agreements with us. And both sides were represented by senior expert banking counsel who knew and advised their clients, and it's alleged in the complaint they did, that they would have to enter into agreements with the OCC. So the OCC sent them some agreements that said, you've got at this bank about a $400 million capital requirement. You need to have a backup fund to make sure that that capital is solid. And we want that at the bank level. And in addition, if for some reason that fund isn't set up or it has investment losses or becomes inaccessible for any reason, then we want a guarantee from the parent companies that they'll put the money in.
Mr. Shapiro,
yes,
let me interrupt you here. The factual flavor that comes through from the Vice Chancellor's opinion is different from the factual flavor that you've communicated to us. That is, this entire controversy over the backup fund, the willingness of or the demand by the OCC that Blackstone sign on to, basically to back up an additional $400 million of capital, came about in the ordinary course of negotiating or at least trying to implement the merger agreement, including getting the requisite regulatory approvals. And basically, as the opinion recites it, a demand was made by the OCC. Blackstone decided that it wasn't able or willing to comply with it and wasn't obligated to do it and didn't, and that was the end of the story. If those were the facts, would there be any case here?
Well, that's not what the complaint alleges.
I understand that.
Well, but we're on a motion to dismiss.
No. Answer my question.
I'm going to try to, Your Honor.
If that is all the complaint alleged, would there be a case?
If the complaint alleged that Blackstone had no obligation, or let me put it a little more precisely, if the complaint alleged that Aladdin was not liable to pay the fee, if Blackstone didn't make a filing, didn't enter into agreements, I would agree with the Vice Chancellor.
That's not my question. I mean, basically, the facts, as they are related in the opinion, differ from yours in that your facts, or the facts that you've just communicated, state that for whatever reason, maybe in bad faith, Blackstone decided that it wanted out of the deal and took steps, to delay or to hinder, refused to acknowledge and accede to the OCC's demand. How is that different? That is, why does that make a legal difference, what Blackstone, subjectively decided it wanted to do?
Well, because in some ways it doesn't, but Blackstone has made that Aladdin has made that the center of its defense, that as a factual matter, an obligation was imposed. And what the complaint alleges, and actually submits very substantial proof in documentary form to show, is that there was no economic cost to either Aladdin or Blackstone arising out of the OCC agreements. Because the...
But there would be a legal obligation, right?
No, Your Honor. No. There was nothing. And indeed, Mr. Walker, the senior banking lawyer for Blackstone and Aladdin, in a letter to the OCC, acknowledged that. and said,
so if Blackstone signed what the OCC wanted, there would be no legal obligation?
That's right, because as a functional matter, once the fund was set up by a reduction in the purchase price, as long as it was kept in cash or in Treasury securities, there was no set of circumstances under which the backup guarantee could ever be called upon. And that's what's alleged in the complaint. That's what Mr. Walker says in his letter to the OCC. That's what the OCC says in its letter to Mr. Walker.
Why does that matter legally?
Because if, well, let me step back, because this is a case about what's in the contract and what the complaint alleges. The contract requires Aladdin to provide all information that the OCC requires to process the application. The OCC's change of bank control manual, which is attached to the complaint, says to process your application, you will have to enter into agreements with us if we request it. The OCC sends a series of letters, all of which are attached to the complaint.
I think you're saying that the OCC, you know, basically called or labeled the its demand that that Blackstone sign off on the $400 million backup as information.
It did, and
okay. What you're doing is basically shoehorning the OCC's construction of the term information into the term information as it appears in the merger agreement.
Yeah, I actually am not, Your Honor. Let me explain why. 6.5.3 says you'll give all information that the agency requires. The agency says to you, I require this information to process your application. I'm not shoehorning it. The experts who wrote that provision, the banking experts, knew what they were talking about. The OCC's manual tells you what that means. This is not me doing. This is what the OCC says in its manual. It's what the contract says. You'll give whatever information a government agency requires to process your application to that agency. That's your absolute obligation. So this isn't something I created or made up. This is
you still have a disconnect, unless you can connect it, between the OCC's interpretation of the term information and what the merger agreement requires.
This is a motion to dismiss. If there are alternative interpretations of a contract, a court on
well,
a motion
me,
to dismiss
give me
can't
your
pick
interpretation.
One over the other.
I'm sorry, I'm asking for your interpretation.
My interpretation is that when somebody agrees to provide all information an agency requires to process this application and then declines to do that, especially when there's no economic cost to it, that that's a breach of the contract.
So information is the equivalent of a guarantee and vice versa?
That's what the OCC said, yes. In three letters sent to Blackstone and Aladdin saying we can't process your application unless you enter into these agreements. And Alliance, and remember, Alliance Data had made these agreements cost-free to Aladdin and Blackstone so that if there is no cost, and if the agency who you agreed to, you filed an application with, says to you repeatedly, I need this information to process your application, I can't approve it without this information, and you say, sorry, I won't give it to you, and your contract requires you to give, without condition, all information that's required by the agency. I don't know why that doesn't make a breach of contract.
I realize this is a motion to dismiss, but does the record reflect why, if they were going to get $400 million in cash that was totally secure, they still wanted Blackstone's guarantee?
Because it's a government agency, and they wanted to make sure that their precedents, and they have a whole series of precedents that both they and the FDIC had put into place over the last several years that said this is what we need. And you know, Vice Chancellor Strine asked the same question. I can't give you a better answer. It is, you know, a part of the bureaucratic operation.
Reasons not to reason, wife.
Yeah, well, you know, anybody who goes to apply for a driver's license, right? But, in fact, if there is a question as to whether or not there was some obligation, that's not for a motion to dismiss.
I understand. Well, going back to Justice Ridgely's question, though, your argument seems to be that in the context of this type of arrangement, information is a term of art, and everyone that's familiar with that term of art would understand that it could include a guarantee requirement.
It is, Your Honor, and my argument is actually even one step back from that, which is that if there is some question about what the contract means, if it's ambiguous in this respect, that's not resolvable in a motion to dismiss. It's just a basic procedural position.
So this information argument, is that essential to your position on this appeal?
I think it's the basis on which, one of the bases on which I should win. I think there are also a whole.
Was it presented to the Vice Chancellor?
It certainly was. Indeed, I think I put my oral argument on that in the brief, because the Vice Chancellor was the one that initiated this sua sponte. He asked my friend, was there any obligation on Blackstone's part to make a filing? And he said no. And when I got up, I said, that's not right, 6.5.3. And we argued it at great length. Nobody asked for further briefing on it, which would obviously have been granted, had been asked for. And then the Vice Chancellor declined to decide the issue, which I think is a pretty fundamental breach of the obligation on a motion to dismiss, to search the complaint and find if any of the facts pled under any theory, whether articulated or not, make out a cause of action. Here we have, in paragraph 49 and 68, a specific allegation that Aladdin breached the contract by not providing information that the OCC asked for. And we attach the letters from the OCC saying that, and we attach the merger agreement. So the one argument that that we have over it is whether, by not saying 6.5.3 in that paragraph, we somehow waived an argument.
Do you want to, you're down to the 4 minutes of the five you wanted to reserve.
Well, if there are other questions, I had a few more things to say, but I'm out of time for the moment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
My morning.
Name is Bruce Angelillo. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you this morning. I speak on behalf of the appellees, and I appear to argue for affirmance of the decision below. And if I may begin, Your Honor, by talking about what this case really is. And this is a case of contract interpretation. It's a contract that was fully integrated. It's a contract as pursuant to Delaware law is subject to the interpretation as a matter of law by the court. The appellants are arguing on appeal three provisions of the contract, none of which provides them with a basis to state a claim in this case. If I may, just review them briefly. They're arguing 6.56, 6.5.1, and 6.5.3. The first, 6.5.6, is the so-called negative covenant. It is a conventional, classic, negative covenant that obligates Aladdin, the party to the contract, not Blackstone, the non-party to the contract. Aladdin, the party to the contract, not to take any actions to thwart the merger, and pursuant to that agreement, that provision also provides that it reaches the parent, Blackstone, as well. That is to say that it is Aladdin's responsibility if Blackstone fails to honor that obligation. Again, it's a negative covenant. This is the only provision that arguably touches the parent, that is to say, Blackstone, the non-party, who declined to grant the concession as a volunteer to the request by the OCC in connection with the request for the $400 million source of strength backup guarantee. The second provision that the appellants argue is the so-called reasonable best efforts provision, which is 6.5.1. That provision does not reach Blackstone. It does not reach the non-party. It does not obligate Alliance State Aladdin, the contract party, to cause Blackstone to do anything in respect to OCC approval. The third is the information request, which is 6.5.3, and I'll just note and come back to it, that that information request, again, does not reach Blackstone. It obligates the parties, that is, Aladdin. Now, I would like to just touch on a few points that Mr. Shapiro made in his opening remarks that would help focus my argument. The first is he argues from paragraph 33 of the complaint. And paragraph 33 of the complaint, we're hearing him argue that this is the motivation for Blackstone not to be the volunteer that Alliance Data would like it to have been in acceding to the request of the OCC to put in or commit $400 million of additional capital. Now, I won't belabor it, but even under the notice pleading standard in this state and with respect to the plausibility standard in this state, I do believe that it is insufficient to just say, under pressure from its lending banks, that is insufficient to allege a fact. That's just a bald conclusion.
Well, if it were sufficient to allege a fact, would it matter legally?
No. It would not make any difference as a matter of law to the issue at hand as to whether or not Blackstone decided because a lender whispered in its ear that it didn't want to do this deal and there'll be other deals, Blackstone, and you're going to need our financing. So figure out some way to get out of it. Even if something like that were to have happened, and I will not speak outside the record, it did not, but even if that were the case, Your Honor, this contract does not reach Blackstone. Whatever its motives may have been.
Well, it does to the extent of the antitrust approvals, right?
It does. And in connection with the antitrust.
And that could have required Blackstone to divest itself of certain interests, right?
That's correct.
So there's a financial impact on that.
There is.
So is it arguable that the failure to specifically provide for the OCC guarantee was an oversight, not that was obviously or that was otherwise contemplated by the agreement?
My answer to that, Your Honor, is that this was a carefully negotiated contract by sophisticated parties, and Alliance Data had been living with a subsidiary supervised by the OCC, had been through the transfer process previously, and they come to the table and negotiate and execute a contract. And in connection with the OCC supervised bank, they used a reasonable best efforts. With respect to antitrust issues, it was a hell or high water. With respect to another financial bank institution, Utah, they used a different approach. But what they did was they treated each one specifically and negotiated a specific standard. And with respect to the transfer of the OCC chartered bank, they only went to reasonable best efforts, and they did not impose any effort on the non-party Blackstone as opposed to the antitrust hell or high water divestiture provision. So the parties took care of it. The risk of the OCC doing something, frankly, irrational rested with Alliance Data, not with Aladdin, the purchaser.
Well, how do you relate all of that to Mr. Shapiro's argument that your argument is that this was a sophisticated investor who has been dealing with this type of matter before and knew all the rules? And Mr. Shapiro tells us one of the rules is that information means guarantee, and that to the extent everybody knew that, they thought they were protected without having Blackstone as a party to the agreement. Now, I'm assuming you don't agree with the argument or the analysis, but tell us where it falls apart.
Sure. First place it falls apart is in the language of the contract itself. And that's where I think we can start and stop. counsel stood up and said that 6.5.3, with respect to information, specifically addresses the OCC issue. And that since you could go to some OCC manual, and I'll accept for sake of argument, I disagree with this characterization, but you go to the OCC manual, and if you read it, you would see that the OCC uses as a nomenclature information, contrary to the way everybody else uses information. Okay. But if you go to 6.5.3, it says, and this is the provision of the agreement that he's relying on, each party shall furnish all information required to be included in any application or other filing to be made pursuant to the rules and regulations of any governmental entity initiated in connection with the transactions provided for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's not the OCC. If you go to the definition of governmental entity in the contract, it lists every generic regulatory body, state, local, federal, whatever it is. If they really were to argue that going into this agreement, that this provision was meant to say that if the OCC asks for $400 million additional from a non-party, that signing the guarantee is information, frankly, that it's ridiculous. But putting that aside,
so your point is
the drafts people.
Your point is that no one would construe information to mean a guarantee, or that the OCC is not a governmental entity.
No, what I'm saying is that no reasonable person would conclude that providing information equates to making an additional $400 million commitment. The second part is the language of the agreement, or the language of the provision to which they're citing, is a generic reference. It's not speaking to the OCC and tying the quote information to some OCC specific definition. It's a generic reference.
But you're not arguing that OCC is not a governmental entity.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. But what I'm saying is 6.5.3 is not directed specifically to the OCC.
So you're saying to the extent it was broad and very inclusive, there's no reason to superimpose the OCC's unique definition of information on everyone else.
Thank you for saying it much better than I was succeeding at. Yes, Your Honor. I will also point out that if you were to buy the argument with respect to 6.5.3, that the unconditional obligation of the party, Aladdin, to deliver Blackstone's signature on a $400 million guarantee to the OCC is included in that provision, then it violates the most fundamental construction of contracts, and that 6.5.3 therefore reads 6.5.1, the reasonable best efforts provision, completely out of the agreement. It doesn't work. Judge Jacobs, you asked a question about the factual flavor. And I want to just address that for a moment between Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion and what you heard earlier today. And there isn't a question of a factual dispute here. The facts are undisputed, and that is because the complaint attaches as exhibits the litany of correspondence back and forth with the OCC right up to the conclusion when the merger agreement was terminated. So we're not talking about some version of the facts and another version of the facts. The appellants put the documentary facts in evidence as part of the complaint.
But they also put their spin or superimpose their spin on those facts. Well, isn't that spin, if properly pled, also to be taken into account on a motion to dismiss?
Only in reference to only reasonable inferences that may be drawn from those facts. But the facts at the end of the day, that only the only facts that count, the only facts that count are fundamentally are the exhibit C to the complaint, which is the March 5 letter from the OCC, where it rejects the previous proposals and says flatly that Blackstone must provide some type of financial measure of financial support for the bank. And the other fact that counts is exhibit R to the complaint, which is the April 16 letter from the OCC, which says, quote, that Blackstone and the Blackstone funds would be required to provide secondary backup security of $400 million that the bank could draw on. Those are the facts. They're not in dispute. Blackstone is not a party to the merger agreement. Blackstone did not have an obligation to provide that $400 million backstop financing. That was the OCC's position, and Blackstone declined to accede to it.
Well, I understand that your position is that even if the court is required to take into account the factual slant, you know, that's alleged in the complaint, you know, basically those facts are not material to the legal analysis.
Your Honor, I agree with that.
Well, let me be more specific.
I agree with that.
The claim here, there are two claims here, and they're related. One is that, you know, the only motivation that Blackstone had for not signing off on the $400 million backup arrangement was that its creditors were putting pressure on Blackstone to get out of the deal. And secondly, that there was no reason not to sign because in reality there would have been no exposure to liability.
Well,
tell me if this is right. I understand your position to be that even if both of those facts are treated as true, it doesn't matter legally.
The court below asked me that question, Your Honor, and in this and to borrow the Vice Chancellor's words, to put it in the starkest of light, at the end of the day, if it were the case, and let's just assume it were the case, that Blackstone decided, even though that this backstop guarantee, we're just going to assume for sake of argument, is completely riskless and costless, that as a matter of law, it was a free agent. It was a volunteer. It could do what it wished to do or not do. And so as at the end of the day, as a matter of law, in the starkest of light, it could have declined for any reason or no reason at all, as a matter of contract law.
Well, I thought the Vice Chancellor also referenced what he saw as Blackstone's business model, and that it would be inconsistent with that model to put a great many things at risk simply because you wanted to go into a new venture.
Well, I don't believe it's, at the end of the day, relevant to the issue as a matter of law. But, Your Honor, this $400 million backstop guarantee, under any sort of fair review, is not riskless or costless.
Well, that was my point, that there would be good reasons why Blackstone didn't want to risk everything simply to get involved in a new venture.
Exactly.
Or risk $400 million as opposed to everything.
You know, it was a backstop secondary guarantee, but it was in the amount of $400 million. Things can happen. Now, Blackstone has to call on its investors if that $400 million was ever called. That means that $400 million of capital that would otherwise be invested in other things needs to be put on the shelf. That has a cost. What happens down the road if there were to be such a call? The fund at that point may be winding down. How do you make that work? And what happens if it does get called? Is it a gift to Alliance Data? Do they get a note? Do they get diluted? Do they get more stock? How does it work? One of the things that the OCC was asking for was as part of this was that Blackstone signed on. Once it signed on, in the form of the agreements that Kalman and Kalsa are exhibits to the complaint, once it's signed on, Blackstone can't get out, even if it doesn't own any more, even if it doesn't own Alliance Data anymore, unless and until the OCC lets them go. So why would, you know, why would a private equity investor want to voluntarily submit to the jurisdiction of a federal agency with no exit?
Well, wasn't that the model of another transaction that the parties were aware of?
There was another transaction that they talk about, the TPG Hellman Friedman precedent. Now, I'm going outside the record, but my recollection is we're talking about a very small dollar amount. And I don't remember all of the aspects of it, but I'm afraid to say this, but it might be about $10 million was at issue there. I could be wrong.
Well, what is in the record on that?
Nothing, other than an allegation there was a TPG Hellman precedent. That's an allegation in the complaint. Now, again, let's just assume for sake of argument that the parties knew that there had been a prior occasion where the OCC, in a certain circumstance, had asked a non-party to provide some guarantee. Well, if you accept the complaint at face value, and again, we're now talking, we're getting into parole evidence land, but let's put that aside as well. But if you accept it at face value, what that means is both sides going into this transaction knew that that could be a possibility, that the OCC might ask for something from a non-party. The parties negotiated a contract that did not provide for the non-party here to provide that obligation. So I think you look at the four corners of the contract as it's written. If there are any other questions, Your Honors, I'd be happy to answer them, but I think I'm out of time.
Your Honor, thank you very much.
I think, if I may, that my friend's argument in the last portion illustrates why motions to dismiss are not trials, because what we heard was a fairly lengthy factual recitation outside of the complaint that would have to be under oath in front of a trial judge, and then a judge would assess the credibility of those claims. But the complaint doesn't contain any of those purported facts. Let's talk about plausibility for a second. The argument that's being made by Aladdin is that in a $7.8 billion transaction where there were multiple bidders, the board of directors of this company decided to grant a free option to Aladdin to walk away from the deal at any time at no cost, even though there was a $170 million termination fee, because all Blackstone had to do was not make the filing with the OCC. There would not be approval, and Aladdin would have no obligation. I don't think anyone would suggest that that's a plausible scenario. The notion that because 6.5.3 addresses all governmental agencies, that somehow the parties who were very focused on the need to get approvals from the banking agencies didn't have Mr. Walker, Mr. Angelo's partner, Mr. Eklund, the expert on the Alliance side, dealing with these issues and didn't understand them, I think is not plausible also. The Vice Chancellor did ask counsel whether, I think in his terms, this was a starker, where Blackstone could simply refuse to make a filing and kill this deal and there would be no cost. And the answer that was given was not the answer that was given here today. It was, well, maybe that would be a breach of the best efforts obligation. There might be a damages remedy. That was the answer that was given to that question. It's in the appendix. This is a new theory, the free option theory. It's one that is counter to common sense, counter to experience. And it isn't what the contract says, because if the contract was going to give them a free option, why is there a $170 million termination fee if they walk away from the deal? Why is there a provision in 6.5.6 that says no one, parent companies included, is permitted to do anything, take any action, which would reasonably be expected to prevent or materially hinder or delay the closing of this merger?
Well, the Vice Chancellor makes the distinction between negative and affirmative covenants, and he cites authorities that apparently do as well. Why doesn't that matter?
Because it's the kind of teleological pigeonholing that doesn't deal with content, with all due respect to the Vice Chancellor. It is an absolute obligation that is different from the best efforts obligation. The best efforts obligation addresses positive actions that one must take, recognizes that parties don't have absolute control. So it says you have to use your reasonable best efforts. This one says, on the negative side, it is negative, says you won't do anything that stops this merger from happening.
Well, isn't there a little teleology in your position? I mean, the parties, if they wanted to contract for Blackstone to be on the hook for whatever the OCC demanded, could have explicitly said so. I mean, they did it with respect to the antitrust divestiture.
I don't know.
So, I mean, you have
I don't know that that's teleological, though, Justice Day, because there are a lot of different ways in merger agreements to get what you need to do.
So is it your position that if you have a negative covenant, you don't need an affirmative covenant?
No. My position is that almost every one of these contracts, for a very good reason, has this covenant that says we may not be able to think of what it is you could do, but you're not going to do anything that stops this merger from happening. And that's the reason we put them in there. Because we're not smart enough to figure out all the different things people could do. Antitrust is easy because everybody focuses on that and says, all right, you're not going to acquire anything, and if you do or you have something that's a problem, you'll divest it. But there's a whole range of possibilities in this kind of a complex merger at this kind of price level.
Well, don't people understand differently? You won't do anything to make this, prevent this from happening from you will do everything to make this happen.
Well,
those terms that refer to different concepts.
You know, those of us who have spent time writing these things have concluded, and I think Jim Freund in his book says the same thing, which is whether you call it a negative or positive is really simply a question of phrasing. It doesn't change the substance of it. And for those of us who are old enough to remember when Mr. Freund wrote that book, it's sort of the Bible of the merger industry, Anatomy of a Merger, named after a then-popular movie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.